Hello and welcome to the Wild Ones podcast, a show where we chat about bike stuff. This week, I am joined by producer Emily and bike mechanic Nick. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Yeah?
Yeah, good. I actually have some exciting news.
Yeah, shoot.
So we actually might be one step closer to getting Geraint Thomas on our podcast. Maybe. So the backstory of this is I have just set up the Cade Media Instagram channel. At Cade Media Official, if anyone wants to go and follow us. And I've been putting out some little clips from our podcast. And one of those was the episode that we did with Perry.
Preda
Ab Gwyneth. And one of those clips is him talking about when Geraint Thomas won the tour.
Yep.
And I tagged Geraint Thomas in it. And who liked it? Geraint Thomas. He knows we exist. So that's the first step.
Yep.
And then the second step is...
asking him?
Slipping into his DMs.
Yeah.
Asking him. And then the third step, he just has to say yes. So what I'm saying is we're a third of the way there.
One third, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think we can get him to Newcastle?
I mean, maybe.
Would we have to go to like Saint-Tropez to record it?
Because I mean, that would be a terrible shame, but I'm sure that we could manage it.
Right. So should we get stuck into some news?
Mm.
So Lance Armstrong has popped up in the news for saying he can't understand why the current era of pros are so friendly to each other. So he shared a clip of himself on a podcast where he says, and I'm going to say it's kind of worded very weirdly, but this generation now, these guys go hammer, race each other, some guy will lose. The guy who wins is waiting at the finish line. They're fucking hugging it out. I'm like, what? He added, I'm impressed with this generation of cyclists. In many ways, they are more talented, but they do not compete like we did. Hugs and high fives, this would be totally foreign to me. You're just waiting there so you can hug it all out after you just lost. I'm not saying that our generation was the way to do it or that I was proud. I think it's kind of cool to see, but it wasn't like that for us. Never even crossed my mind. Thoughts?
I'm embarrassed to say this, but I kind of agree with him completely.
Do you?
Gladiator style, man. You're fighting it out. That guy that's just beaten you has taken food off your kid's table.
No,
you've lost.
That's so not true. Because they're salaried.
They get bonuses for winning.
But the difference between first and second wouldn't be much.
I would be happy to shake the guy's hand and congratulate him because he's beaten me. The better man's won on the day. But I would be livid for at least half an hour afterwards. And then obviously we can be friends again. Similar to like the rugby, you see them fighting it out on the field. And then afterwards, like, I miss the old days when there was battles. Lance Armstrong versus Ulrich, the whole kind of like...
But this is still happening. It's just when they're finishing, much like your analogy of rugby, they finish the race and they go, all right, the battle is over.
But I'm not high-fiving the guy for beating me.
I'll shake his hand
and congratulate him. I'm not high-fiving him. I'm not going to be like celebrating his win for him. Yeah, I mean,
I think it's really good to see. And I think Pogacar is at the forefront of being... nice rather than being an asshole. And he's very pleasant. He posted pictures of him on the podium coming third, like really happy with the podium and that his mates had done better than him, but he was still happy with the result that he got. And I think it's really nice to see positivity and good role models in sport that doesn't always have to be about being aggressive, because once it finishes, it's finished.
I agree with on the podium all of that completely. I mean, third is still, it's an excellent achievement. I mean, it's people that dream, well, all cyclists dream to just get in the top 20, which is a placing in some of these.
Don't you typically call third, second loser?
Yes, but obviously, that's true as well. But yeah, but at the same time, it's the competitiveness at all during the race, when it's happening, I'm just more for... yeah, I want to see more of a battle.
A battle.
They're all getting paid money in the end to entertain us. And that's how I want to be entertained. I want like Eben Etzebeth of the South African Springboks. You know, that's what I want to see in the cycling. You know, like anger and then afterwards calm down, be happy.
But that is what you described. They're battling really hard in the race.
Not
and
on the finish
once
line.
It's finished, they're then going, right, well, it's done now. I don't need to be aggressive
5 minutes
anymore.
Later, maybe. Yeah? I mean, it didn't run by 5 minutes.
Interestingly, not to be defending Lance Armstrong. However, because this is ultimately, in a sense, it's talking about sportsmanship. And I had a little look into this. And there are scenarios in the early tours when Lance was battling Jan Ulrich. And
ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And I think Jan has a crash and Lance basically slows down and waits for him. And vice versa, Lance has an issue and Jan slows down. And it's the idea, and they talk about this and they kind of say, you know, you don't want to win because someone else crashed. And it's basically seen as part of the
mutual
sportsmanship
respect,
that you...
definitely important. That, I mean, I miss those days. I miss all... I mean, I'm not saying they're not doing it now. They probably still are. But I think also the other thing is it's generational. It's what I grew up with. Now, I mean, I can talk about... I've seen some horrible things. I mean, obviously, it can go completely the other way. I've seen a lad that wanted to stage in the tour. I'm not going to name him, but I've seen a guy spit on the winner because he came second.
Oh, my God.
Which is, like, obviously taking it to the extreme. And I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is I wouldn't high five or shake his hand, congratulate him, but high five for me is too far.
There were a couple of interesting comments under the article, one of which was, prolific doper thinks good sportsmanship is bad for the sport. Which I think is quite amusing. Someone else just replied with a gif from The Simpsons, which shows a newspaper clipping of Grandpa and the headline, Old Man Yells at Cloud.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, Lance Armstrong, whenever he says anything, it's going to come up in the news because...
it's Lance.
Yeah, it's very polarised opinions. And there was a lot of talk around the fact that people think it's good that there's not as much toxicity. I think he was kind of a poster child for not only the doping, but also the
aggression
and toxicity that he brought with it, right?
He was known for bullying people so much that they weren't willing to like attack him and things like that. He used to just tell people to get back in the peloton rather than like go off the front because it didn't suit what he had planned for the race.
I think that's a more important point because unfortunately at that time, sport-wise, there was a thing came out a while ago saying if his jersey got taken off, if they banned everybody, took their results off them for taking drugs, I think the winner of the Tour de France dropped down to like the 20th place or something, which is, they all got caught doping in the end.
Do you think there is an argument that because of the presence of social media and just like cameras on famous people constantly anyway, that there's this idea that you're always being monitored? And do you think that makes people perform in a nicer way?
Yeah, 100%. It's for the brand.
Might it be performative? Is what I'm saying. Maybe inside they are still that kind of aggression or whatever, or if that was normalized and that would still be happening. But perhaps this sense of being watched constantly makes...
I don't think it is possible to be as competitive as these people are without it being the killer instinct, Mike Tyson, fighter, win or die mentality, which Nick is referring to. I don't think it's possible for them to not be like that, but it is possible for them to not show that and actually be polite and nice and respectful.
There's always the aspect of editing as well.
Yeah.
I mean, Jimmy edits all our build videos where happy and friendly and quiet. Yeah, I mean, and that's definitely not how the build video goes in my mind.
I edit these podcasts to get rid of the most controversial parts.
That's why we film for 3 hours to get an hour-long episode.
Well, speaking of dopers, did you see what happened at an amateur race in Spain earlier this month? So anti-doping testers turned up and 130 riders mysteriously abandoned the race.
Yeah.
So this happened at a race in Alicante. 182 riders took to the start line and only 52 finished. This was a huge drop-off rate even compared to previous races. One anonymous rider told the Spanish website Cyclo21, "Everyone knows who's at it and who's not. Wherever there are tests, curiously, the same people do not finish the races in order to avoid the test. Of course, without proof, we cannot make accusations, but it's all very obvious." So Francis has told us a story before when we've had a conversation about this, that when he was at a Belgium Kermesse race, there was 150 people on the start race. A drug car turned up, probably not the kind of drug car that you would get in Newcastle and other areas that I grew up in. And miraculously, only 50 people ended up starting the race because 100 of them disappeared. Should there be more anti-doping measures at lower level of racing? Well, it sounds like there's a bit, but how far down the chain does it go?
I'm going to say yes, because back home, we had quite a big cycling club, and then all the clubs race against each other. And you'd go on, I was younger, so racing a lot faster than I am now. And we'd go to club rides in the morning and be three or four clubs showing up together. And the lads would ride hard. And then you get guys beating the lads that are racing new CI Elite races, but they never entered any of the amateur races over there.
Yeah.
So there were people doping just to beat their mates on club rides, which is ridiculous. But the problem for me is that I get the whole thing of people can say, oh, there's no harm in it because nobody's taking money off anybody else. But I think the problem's not that. The problem's the health issues.
Yeah.
Because I know loads of them aren't riding bikes anymore. I know of a lot of people from back in the day that are now like, they're ill. I mean, people with heart problems and things. There's stuff you don't know because they're just taking all these drugs and it's dangerous. So I think more for, not for a sporting thing. I don't really care if you've won because of that in an amateur race or, well, obviously I do, but that's not my concern. The concern is more the health risks.
I think it also sets an expectation of what other people have to do to be competitive.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the other reason that it's bad. For example, there could be juniors in lower level races, which, you know, there's usually, well, not usually, there are occasionally people where you go, that person might be doing something to make their performance better than it was historically. And it encourages other people to also do things that they shouldn't be doing to try and match other people's level of progress. And then presumably that makes it very easy or very desirable to younger people to do it. Because I think you see it happened a lot with like anabolic steroids and people that went to the gym. Is like historically you'd get all these bodybuilders that were massive in their like 20s or whatever, and then before you know it you've got 14-year-olds doing steroids, injecting steroids because they want to be massive because they think that that's what they need to do.
The horrible thing about it is that everybody keeps forgetting. So I'm going to use Lance as an example. Back when he was doping, and some of these professional cyclists and current ones, if they're doing it or not, is people are forgetting these people have scientists, they've doctors, they've got everybody in their corner. If they are doing it, who's testing them and putting them in labs and everything is dosed out and it's weighed for weight. And there's a lot of, they're not just going to the local gym and buying steroids or EPO from some pharmacy in Turkey or somewhere. It's literally
monitored.
It's a science and medically monitored. And then you get some amateur bloke just goes and buys whatever. I mean, how do you even know what to take? Injects it into himself, how much it is. There's stories of back in the day, I think it was the 70s or so, where people were taking so much EPO that their blood was turning into like tomato sauce.
Well,
they'd have to get up in the middle of the night in the rain, and then they would start talking about...
Do you know the story of Pantani? He used to have to get up every 3 hours through the night.
To ride on a bike.
To do a bit of turboing to keep his blood flowing.
It's dangerous. And that's more the issue, I'd say, for the younger people to kind of also...
It seems crazy, an amateur race. I feel incredibly naive because I did not realise that that was going on at such a low level of sport.
I can see why it does, though. As someone that has historically tried to be competitive, you get to a point where you start the amount of gains you get become smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, like when I was racing 5Ks... I'd get to a point where if I got 2 seconds off of my time, it would be like a result.
Yeah.
Whereas the other option is I could start taking EPO and then I'd probably take another minute off. So I can see the draw to it.
You have to assume though that it must be fairly common in those circles. Because if you, in that position, if you went, well, I'm going to start taking EPO, how do you then get a hold? Like,
This what is the problem. You're not getting it from some doctor.
It must be happening within those circles. You must know a guy that knows a guy. You know what I mean? It must be talked about and known or a...
That's just drugs though, isn't it?
Yeah, perhaps.
That's all drugs.
Explain drug culture to me, Jimmy. Yeah, no, I guess so.
But it'll because I remember with... Because I used to know some people that did do anabolic steroids for going to the gym, so for getting massive. And it would come with, you know, do this, but then also take this primrose oil or whatever it is, because it'll help this, you know, like it comes with an off the record dodgy list of things that you should or shouldn't do to try and give you a better chance of not having weird side effects. I imagine the same thing's going to be for all the performance enhancing space. Yeah. But I don't know. It's the reason it's banned is because it isn't safe. So like, don't do it, kids.
Oh, there's loads of stuff that gives you performance enhancing that isn't banned. I suppose because there's no health risk or it's difficult to monitor. Like caffeine. Caffeine does give you some kind of performance. Some people might say there's tests saying it doesn't, but my experience, I mean, I ride much better when I've had some.
So caffeine, the studies with caffeine are that it reduces your perceived effort. So if you do, you ride FTP effort for an hour with and without caffeine, if you do the same amount of effort with caffeine, it will just feel less painful.
Yeah, RPI, okay.
And therefore you can push more or push longer because it just doesn't feel as hard. So yeah, there's loads of stuff. Beetroot, nitrates, so beetroot juice and things like that. There's loads of things that are not bad for you.
I wonder how much anti-doping testing actually goes on at lower levels.
Not enough.
At lower levels, I think very little.
Yeah, well, like, it's obviously it is obviously happening. Maybe they could take a record of who ducks out and see if it over a season how. There must be, I don't know.
But there's so James has said to me, I don't know, were you in the shop? And he was saying he did a race recently. It was the first time ever in his entire career where he's been where they had testing,
right?
Which is ridiculous because I know he's
and
Conti
he's racing
level,
at Conti level, yeah.
But I mean Conti level. Races with the pro Conti lads, they just don't get paid salaries. And there is the odd occasion where they race against some of the World Tour teams. I mean, you just race against Israel last week. So essentially, the fact that he's never been nobody in the team, yeah, it's a bit of a like, it's not happening enough.
Mm. I would imagine it costs money and they probably go, oh, we don't care if it affects further down the chain. They're not doing it for health, really, are they? They're just doing it because they need to do it at the top end. Whereas I think probably what we're saying is we would like to see it further down the chain so that it stops people even considering it in the first place, because you just go, well, I can't take illegal substances because I'm going to get caught and therefore I'm definitely not going to do it, so I should focus on the stuff that I can do, like training. Now, the latest on the crisis facing cycling retailers. So Giant, the bike manufacturer, their pre-tax profits have almost halved in the last year and its sales were down 16%. Again, they are saying that they're struggling with too much inventory and not enough demand. Meanwhile, demand, that's putting it on the consumer. It's the consumer's fault is basically what that says.
Well,
doesn't it?
I don't think that's what it says, no. It's well, just it does. Their supply outstrips their demand. I think it's just terminology.
But oversupply is what they should use the wording for, not the demand.
Yeah.
We have oversupplied, not they have under-demanded.
Meanwhile, a leaked memo from Trek suggests that it's about to start downsizing its business significantly. Oh, was this a leaked memo? I saw something about this the other day. So they're planning to cut their spending by 10% and reduce product models by 40% by 2026. Again, they're struggling with high stock levels and not enough demand. President John Burke told company leaders the market is in chaos. Is it a sensible move what Trek are doing? I would say absolutely yes. There's more variety than that needs to be. As someone which has historically worked in a manufacturing or production, a product-based business, having lots of different products and models, it's just money. It just costs more and more money just so that you can have them.
So this Trek thing came out at the Taipei Bike Show. I read an article about it. I can't remember what the magazine is called, but it's a magazine that's covering the show. And that's basically where the industry goes. So you get loads of different bike shows where consumers go, you get one where retailers go, and then this one's where the big factories and everybody shows up.
I think I want to go next year.
Oh, definitely. It's be the highlight of my year going there. But they interviewed loads of people that own different manufacturers and or like industries. So like Trek's the owner, like everybody's in charge of all these big companies. And one of them said, which is probably the truest thing I've ever heard anybody say about the industry. And he said, the industry isn't run by business people. It's run by enthusiasts. I mean, that goes down to bike shop level for me as well, I think. And he said, we've got too many monkeys and not enough organ grinders. And like I say, they just bring our stuff in too many levels and SKUs. These figures will be really weird as well, because that would be for last year, 2023, where, and it would have been based off 2021 and 2022, arguably being the two greatest years in the cycling industry. Mm. And people just kept on producing, thinking this lockdown craziness was going to go on forever and ever, and didn't factor in the hangover that's going to happen afterwards. And that's why they're struggling. But it's just a thing of people just think making more and more is better. I know of a clothing company that is bringing out bib tights where they had black bib tights and blue bib tights, but each one of them, they had the logos printed in three different colors. So now you've got two bib tights could just work, but one's got silver logos, one's got white logos, one's got orange logos. And you think to yourself, you'll know how many extra SKUs, and then you have to make for all these sizes and things. And you're just creating more and more and more. And it just makes it much harder for everybody, because if you have to stock in, you have to keep all this extra stock to be able to cover the range. And it's just a thing of kind of condense it down a little bit more.
Yeah,
it's always been better.
I saw something from Sigma Sports founder. Sigma Sports is, I think it's just UK based, isn't it? Retailer.
They probably do sell a bit internationally, but
they're a big shop.
They're ultimately a shop in just outside of London that also have a really good website.
Yeah, big online presence. And they said, someone asked, Road CC asked them about what they thought about Trek's move, and they said they think it's a good time to reset and have a look at what they're offering. And they said that they have done the same thing in the last couple of years.
Giants and all the companies making more and more stuff. It's just, they bring out frame sets in three different carbon layups. And most shops wouldn't even know what the difference between the carbon layups is, let alone the consumer. Just kind of scale that down. And then all the different colors and things like that. And then every year forcing a new colorway, which they've not changed anything on the bike. They've just made a new color. And then they have to get rid of the old ones, and it's all these things. I mean, it's just a thing of...
I guess it's something that works when the market is on the up in terms of people are buying. You want to have as much possible choice for people to buy, I guess. But it then hits you really hard on the way down, doesn't it?
I've always been convinced that the yearly color changes is just to force bike shops
to buy more stock,
to keep buying stock.
Mm. Yeah,
but it isn't even for the consumers. It's just to make bike shops have to constantly buy more.
I know of two of the biggest brands in cycling where people have had the bikes and then had them repainted, and while sanding it down, noticed different colors on a brand new bike, meaning like the old bike's just been painted over.
Wow.
It's just shocking. I mean, your bike's heavier for a fact, but it's just a thing of, yeah, that's the thing, because they try and force shops and saying, you have to take this many bikes if you want to continue being a shop. And it forces you to buy more stuff instead of innovating anything new.
So meanwhile, retailers are seeing a knock-on effect as Wiggle launches at 80% off sale. And I think they're also saying that they are clearing out every single item that they have. So British clothing brand Lusso have said that they simply can't compete. In a recent blog post, they said, we have seen a slight drop in sales this quarter compared to last year, but speaking to other brands, it seems to be normal. The Wiggle closing down sale might have something to do with it, but it would be unfair to hold them fully accountable.
It's everything though, isn't it? Whether it's Wiggle aren't the only one that I've got a sale on currently. All of last year, we basically saw massive sales from every part of the industry. And mm-hmm. If your competitor has a sale, you're forced to do a sale. And we saw, you know, Giant, their profits were halved and sales only went down 16%. So that says they had sales on. Canyon, the same thing happened to them. So mm-hmm. So it's kind of, once one person goes, the rest is doomed to follow, I guess.
But I think it's like toilets. How many toilets do you buy in your lifetime?
I have never bought a toilet.
Well, you have, because you bought a house.
I guess so. I've rented toilets.
And then at some point,
bought a toilet.
A toilet might break and then you have to replace it, or you might do up your bathroom, whatever. Ultimately, it's infrequent, isn't it? There's a limited amount of how many toilets you're going to buy in your life.
Where's this going?
The same thing applies to everything in one capacity or another. How many sets of cycling kit are you realistically going to own before you know, eventually they'll fall apart and you'll want to buy new ones, or you might just want them anyway. If you've already got five sets of kit, the chances are you're not going to need to buy another set of kit for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, perhaps even longer if it's really good quality stuff. So like, everyone has bought all of the stuff they need over the last couple of years because they were really excited about riding bikes and they probably got a deal of the century.
And everything was on sale, yeah.
And now no one, people just don't need as much.
I would go slightly the other way. The way I've seen it is, my analogy used was from you guys as well, having Atticus back in the day, and I saw the club members, people were buying like 6, 7, 8, 9 sets of kits. Chris Healy was buying every single time you guys launched on me, bought stuff because he enjoyed it. But when the cost of living crisis hit slightly, the first thing you're going to cut out is that. Because if you've got 15, 20, I've probably got 200 sets of kit. you don't need more.
Yeah.
So essentially, like, you still want to ride your bike. You're still going to need tires. You're still going to need to service it and things like that. But the one thing that you've got in excess, that was the first thing that was always going to suffer. It will bounce back eventually.
So I think a lot of big brands are going into survival mode. There's a handful of smaller brands or less prepared brands, i.e. Wiggle, I think is probably an example of it, that are less fortunate, and we're probably going to see more brands go pop over the next couple of years. My gut instinct is we are still 18 months from the turnaround and the next cycling boom to come back around.
I think it will be interesting to see, because it's the Olympics year this year, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And 2012 was a really pivotal moment because the UK Team GB did really well in the cycling, mm-hmm. and there was a massive uplift in cycling in this country, and it's kind of what brought about
the boom.
So perhaps if we get good results this year, there will be, I'm not sure it'll be enough to correct what's going on, because everything economical in terms of cost of living will still exist potentially. But it will be interesting to see if it will change perception and get things moving, or at least anchor them so that they're not going further down.
I don't think it'll have any impact.
Same, yeah.
And the main Fair reason enough. Is there isn't any, there's no hype about the Olympics this year. There's no buzz. So I think the 2028 Olympics, which I believe is in LA, is going to be part of the next boom. I think people will get really hyped up about it. I think America will go wild for making it like huge and exciting and marketing the hell out of it. And I think I think there'll be a big buzz around the 2028 one.
But they would have to bring in new disciplines as well.
Like bike jousting.
Yes, exactly that.
Bike javelin.
Bike javelin.
Bike discus.
Bike jousting, you get tandems. Obviously, you put bigger rider on the back, smaller rider on the front. The one on the back's got the lines.
Mm.
Front one's got like a fairing shield thing, obviously, so that they, yeah.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Next, can we spare a thought for Mark Cavendish, who's having a rough start of the season? So he dropped out of the UAE Tour with illness, missed the cutoff time for the Tirreno Adriatico Stage 5, and his DNF at Milano Torino is now his third in a row. He showed a promising start in February's Tour de Colombia, where he got a stage win and a podium. But these latest results cast doubt over his bid to outdo Merckx's stage win record at this year's Tour. So the big question is, do you think he'll achieve his dream of a 35th stage win at this year's Tour de France?
I think everybody misses the point. Cavendish is the greatest sprinter of all time. He's done all of, there's no debating it. The results speak for themselves. He doesn't have to do what all your other cyclists do throughout the entire year, have this massive build up their palmares and wins and things. He's got all the wins. All he needs is one more win. He doesn't need to be fit now. It's great to ride some stuff, but the Tour de France is a long way away for him to gain fitness. He could probably have surgery on something at the moment and still be fine for then. So I think he only needs one win, one stage. And he's going to have several opportunities in the Tour de France. And he's probably the worst person in the world to bet against. I mean, look at him a few years ago when everybody said he stands no chance. And he came out and he just absolutely, he embarrassed the other sprinters. He just needs one. So I think I want him to get more than one. I don't want him to just have one more. I want him to win like four stages in the Tour de France. I'd be happy with one. But yeah, I would never, ever, ever discount him. He's not old enough to be discounted yet either. I mean, back in the day, people were winning. I think it was Cipollini won at like 38 or 39 years old. He was world champion.
Right. So I want him to do well. I think that he is not going to do well. I think that the current level of pro cycling is evolving. I think it's becoming significantly more marginal, and I think the day of the old school pure sprinter is done. I think the pace is getting so high that pure sprinters are no longer even able to get through the race. So I think what we'll see in this year's Tour de France is a pace that is so high that by the time they get to the Champs-Élysées, there's going to be practically no pure sprinters even left in the race.
I don't want him to win the Champs-Élysées. I want to win him one of the first sprint stages. He's a gladiator. He's what we talked about earlier. He's a guy that'll fight. He will die before letting anybody. I mean, all these crashes and things is because there's no gap, but he will go. I mean, that's don't. I was never a fan originally because I think when I was a kid, I liked the wrong sprinters, but he's like a Robbie McEwen back in the day who didn't have a sprint train and just used to fight his way through and kind of win stages when he shouldn't have been winning, like against the odds. That's Cavendish. I mean, I really, really hope he gets it.
It's a good point you made, Jimmy, about the day of the pure sprinter, because I guess a modern day version of that would be someone, I guess, like Wout van Aert, who is very good at a sprint, but is a much more all-rounder, isn't he?
He is way more than a sprinter.
Yeah, yeah.
Him, Matthew van der Poel, they are unbelievable riders. I mean, if you think as well as, I mean, they're at the top of the sport for cyclocross, and then they are at the top of the sport for cross-country mountain biking. Mm. The only discipline they're not entering is downhill.
And speaking of Matthew van der Poel, he just signed a 10-year deal with Canyon, didn't he?
Yeah, which takes him up to the age of about 39. So he's going to pretty much spend his whole career on Canyons.
That's a good move as well. I was talking to Francis about this morning. He was saying, you know, pro cyclists coming towards the end of their careers are struggling to work out where their income comes from. So actually securing a long-term deal at the height of your career, that's potentially then going to see you through to your latter age. I mean, the latter age of 39 or whatever, but
he's a Dutch national hero. You're not telling me he's paying for any food ever again in that country. He doesn't need the 10-year sponsorship.
Yeah, fine. But but you know, you live to your means, and once he's, you know, right now he is number one or he's right up there, but in 10 years time that there's going to be younger, fitter people coming through.
How does that play out for teams? So let's say his team next year is on a different bike. Is he like, oh, I'm not riding your bikes, I'm riding Canyon?
So Alpecin Quickstep have signed with Canyon for another 5 years.
Yeah.
So at the very least, what we will see is him being a pro cyclist for the next 5 years.
So I've heard some stuff where some riders are, I know certain contracts are different. I know there are riders that are signed to bike brands, not to the teams, and they lend the riders to the teams. I don't know the ins and outs of that, but it's
obviously very complicated because it depends on, you know, like Sagan was famous for his relationship with Specialized.
Yeah.
Like he it was just, that's how it worked.
And it's Cannondale originally.
Was it?
Yeah, yeah.
But well, he was the poster boy for Specialized for a long time. And I think ultimately what we're seeing with this Canyon deal is
A similar sort of
Alberzin
de Koenig he rides for.
That's the one, yeah. But ultimately, he's definitely with them for the next 5 years. And then he'll then either renew, knowing that Canyon are part of that deal, or he'll retire and just do whatever else he wants to do, or just do mountain bike, whatever it is. I actually think the interesting thing with those two people is I think what's happening is I feel like Wout van Aert is evolving into the next phase of his career, because a few years ago he was absolutely everywhere. He was so aggressive. He was attacking everything. I think he's either grooming himself into a GC space, or he's just going like proper domestic setup for the world, for the Grand Tours. And I think you've got Van der Poel, which is kind of becoming the character that Van Aert was historically, which is this like really aggressive person.
Yeah, but I think they're still there's too much weight, not too much, but there's a lot of weight beyond Grand Tours. Tour de France is everything to everybody. And it's all good and well. You can get like people have won the tour and that's great, or won five tours, whatever it is. But Van der Poel's won at everything. I mean, he's been cyclocross world champion. He's road world champion. If he wins mountain biking, then there's Olympic champ. There's all like he's a much more rounded cyclist. The last time stuff like this happened was Eddy Merckx days, when he was just winning every single bike race that he entered. It's interesting. It's good to watch. I'm not happy about the Canyon thing, but obviously that's just me.
I think it is a great deal for him. He's never going to get a better deal than right now, I would say, or in the next couple of years. So I think it's a smart move securing a long term. That must cost them a fortune.
Where does Pidcock fit into this?
Pidcock, I think, from what I've heard, is transitioning to world tours, where he'll end up going, because he can climb. I mean, he can descend. Did you watch that Milan San Remo, the last, like how close he was to the wheel?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think people understand the speeds in the corner. You don't know what the guy in front of you is doing, because he's not worried about who's behind him.
It was actually a really interesting the style difference between Van der Poel and Pidcock on that descent was really interesting.
I think Pidcock's, I don't know enough, but I think the only downside for him, not a downside, because there's a plus in loads of aspects, is how small he is.
Mm.
On some of the flat stuff outright, I'm pretty sure if you look at outright power numbers, something like a Matthew Van der Poel or Van Aert
be in a different league, wouldn't it?
Different league. So that's where you have to ride much smarter.
Yeah.
Which is...
Well, it suggests that Pidcock could actually end up being a really good GC rider.
Yeah.
But you've got your Vingegaards and your Pogacars that are absolute babies, and they're not going anywhere for the next 15 years.
I don't want Pidcock to become a GC rider. It'll be great at the same time, but as long as it doesn't sacrifice the way he rides at the moment,
the aggressive
style and things
it's
that.
It's fun to
you
watch
don't want
him,
them
it?
To get to a point where, like Chris Froome's days, and that where everything was very measured. I mean, it's good, and I know where they did it because they had great success at it, but I just don't want racing to be as measured, where it's like they know exactly what was. I want power meters to disappear, radios to disappear, all of that, so that essentially you don't know how much power you're putting through. You just need to go off feel, and if your feel's not good, you could just explode. No radios, meaning your team could be off the front. The team leaders popped at the back, but nobody can tell them. They have to wait until there's somebody next to the road saying, like, you lads need to slow down, mate. And like screaming at the TV because like, slow down, you're like, you're leaving your own guy behind, that kind of stuff. I just think it'll be, in the end, all of this is entertainment. That's it. It's there to entertain us.
Very true.
Not for anything else. They are dancing monkeys and we need them to dance more. Yeah, like entertain us. That's it. It's everybody misses the whole point of this. This is what this is, this podcast. It's to entertain people.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think we've talked about it before, but boxing's kind of seeing that now. It's why, you know, the YouTubers getting into the boxing stuff. It's almost, it's resurgence of the sport because they are making it entertaining. They know what people want to watch. And also, that is a lot of pro cycling analysis we just did then.
So in summary, how many stages is Mark Cavendish going to win?
All the sprint stages up until the big hills.
I say zero.
I haven't seen the course.
No, he's not going to win all. I want him to win all. But
if there are stages that he can win before it gets hilly, then I would say he's in good contention.
Currently, I'm thinking he might not even start it.
That would be devastating for Astana because their whole team has basically been built around him. Mm. But I mean, it's not like they had I was going to say, it's not like they have anything else going for them, which is a very brutal thing to say. No, but ultimately, it's good marketing from them to do that.
Time for another round of overrated or underrated. I'm going to read out a list of things. You're going to tell me if you think they're overrated or underrated. So first up, we have down tubes or top tubes with built-in storage, suggested by Andrew, who says, they seem like a gimmick to me. I've seen them on several newer endurance and gravel bikes, and I don't know how necessary they are or if they come with built-in risk of integrity of the frame from a bike mechanic's perspective.
I don't think there's any risk. For me personally, they're slightly overrated, even though my favorite bike, carbon bike at the moment, has got one. I do like the idea of being able to just put like a raincoat or something in it. I wouldn't keep like my lunch and all my tools and stuff in because it's not easily accessible. You still want a different bag and stuff. But just for like, I think if you're just using it for raincoat or to stack, put away like a gilet or any kind of shake dry thing, great. It's extra storage. In terms of integrity, all these manufacturers are testing before, and if something goes wrong with it, then obviously that's going to get covered by warranties. No way is it going to get out of that.
I think they are overrated because I've never, like, I can just put a top tube bag on or a bar bag or a whatever bag or use my pockets.
Which is extra bags, but it's just...
I don't need the extra space.
No. Rob's got one, like, on his Mog. And he do use, but I think he's using wrong because he puts everything so far hidden in there. When every time he needs to use it, he needs to stop and take his bottle off and all these things to get it out. I would literally just use it to keep in summer, a gilet, and in winter, a raincoat. That's it.
I think it's the kind of thing that, because I imagine Rob is the kind of person that likes his bike neat.
Yes.
And therefore he is willing to jam. And he also probably likes his pockets empty.
Yes.
And therefore he's willing to jam absolutely everything into that frame so that he can keep everything neat and his pockets empty. Whereas that isn't the point of it. It's like, I think it's overrated.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but at the moment I've only seen them on an Envy Mog, which is an incredibly expensive bike, and
Argon 18.
Argon 18.
Chris's Argon 18. Yeah.
And I've seen them on the new Canyon Grail.
It's more thing in mountain bikes. Loads of mountain bikes have them.
Right, okay.
Loads of mountain bikes have them.
At the moment, when it's coming into road / gravel riding, it's on expensive bikes, right? I would say that's a gimmick.
I think the other place is probably some triathlon TT bikes.
Yes, yeah. That's always been a thing on TT because it's about aero, isn't it?
I think for mountain bikes, they are underrated just because in a mountain bike, generally speaking, saddle bags and bags is a bit more of a hassle if you're using it. I'm talking enduro kind of trail riding and things like that, where and you've got smaller triangles, so bottles, there's not a lot of space. The exact opposite to what with road bikes and gravel bikes. So there, yes, to keep your multi-tool and a couple of things you might need in the frame is probably the most logical place to keep things. TT bikes as well, because everybody wants mega aero.
Also from Andrew, we have studded tires. So he says, I live in Vermont and we get a bunch of snow and ice, although less so lately thanks to global warming. I know a lot of commuters' bikes have them, but I feel like gravel tires do a good job. Maybe they come from a different time when you couldn't put wider tires on rim brake bikes. Do they still have a place? I have always wanted to use studded tires.
I bought some this year.
They're really hard to get hold of in this country.
They're obscenely expensive as well.
Well, there is, yeah.
Underrated. If you've got ice, I know we don't have snow over here, but we do have ice. Icy roads and things. I don't mind crashing. I crash almost every gravel ride, but that's my own fault. Where I'm just sick and tired for a couple of weeks in January every year on the coast to coast or some of the trails, hitting a patch of ice and then just going down without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
And you always crash hard. Nigel broke his hip in the Tan Muir a couple of years ago on the ice, and then he lay there for 4 hours waiting for an ambulance.
Oh.
I'm surprised he didn't die.
So for me, studded tires are specifically for ice.
Yeah.
Whereas quite often when it's snowy, or at least in this country, you can actually ride on snow and not need a studded. Whereas we get a lot of 2 degrees to -4 where it's constantly bouncing in and out of freeze and thaw. So we get a lot of melted snow or ice, which then becomes water, and you get these horrible sheets of ice. So studded tires for me I've always wanted them because we get that a lot in this country. If you don't get into ice a lot, then you don't need studded tires. And if you've got lots of snow, then probably you don't need them as well. No. Because
and if you're going to ride on the road loads, because on the road, generally speaking, the ice melts from the cars, the heat, but and the noise of the tires. But yeah, just knowing gravel wise, you're not going to worry about the ice at all. It's, for me, it's worth it. They're very expensive. They're incredibly heavy.
So I think they are underrated, but only because I haven't used them yet.
I've got some for your howler for next year.
Send them over. Next up, we have a suggestion from Yoris, who says, it's the subject on this is bar tape choice. So there are hundreds of different ones for sale, yet we ride on the rubber hoods 99% of the time. If feel, grip, thickness, and vibration dampening are so important, why hasn't anyone come up with a different type of aftermarket hood yet? I think it is a very good point. I actually do think it's a very good point, because I am one of those people which says I don't use the drops pretty much ever. I spend, like he says, 99% on the hoods, and occasionally I'll put my hands on the top where it's taped.
Generally speaking, your hands on the hoods, but they're like... ball of, not, I don't know what you call it, but like the bottom of your palm.
It's called the heel.
The heel of your palm is on handlebar tape, and that's where most pressure goes through. Next thing is that I think as big as some of these handlebar tape manufacturers are, none of them actually, well, I'm going to say none. Very few of them make their own handlebar tape. They all just buy, there's generic companies that make handlebar tape, and everybody just rebrands them. Like our Triple B stuff we use is exactly the same stuff Fabric uses, and a few other brands. But the company's making hoods. Bizarrely, it's a big thing. If you see Shimano releases a new group set, or Campag or SRAM, they always go on about the development they've put into their hoods. So they more think about the important thing there is grip and
ergonomics
and sweat and things like that. So it is good. It is a good point. But at the same time, if you've got massive problems with your hands, no amount of tape's really going to work, because you'll go too thick. Get yourself, shameless plug over here, a Redshift suspension stem. That's made a massive difference for me.
Ultimately,
way more than tape.
My opinion on this, and I think you're probably going to agree as well, is buy cheap bar tape that's got a bit of grip on it and a bit of firmness.
Some of the expensive tape is completely a waste of money. From a bike mechanics perspective, if you buy something that doesn't have a sticky backing, where it's more of a gel backing, that's better for me, because you get tape in that's been glued to your handlebars. It takes me longer to take the tape off than it does to wrap the bars again, and then whatever wraps easily. Cork tape bizarrely is massively underrated, I think. Just, it's nice.
So what we're saying, bar tape choice, overrated or underrated?
Overrated. There's way too much of it. You just need like £5 piece of cork tape or whatever.
Don't think you get it for £5, but £10. Yeah.
Next up, we have Fluff Up of the Week. There is a lot for this one, isn't there?
Mm.
So the first one is from me, which I'm going to keep very brief. I didn't think I had anything to do yesterday, so I decided to work on the house instead. And then when I got to the end of the day, I realized I missed 4 meetings, which I will have to reschedule. So if you are one of those 4 people that I missed the conversation with, I do sincerely apologize, and I will reschedule you shortly.
Cade Media's got no sponsors left.
Slacking off while the boss is away.
And then there's also some special mentions for Francis Cade on his trip in Malaysia. We've got Lawrence, who forgot the skewer for his tail fin, so they had to botch something together. Francis fell down a hole and cut his knee. And also, I noticed this morning that he uploaded the most recent video at 5 a.m. when typically we would upload it at 1 in the afternoon.
I can't believe them lot being tail fin product testers /
ambassadors,
all of this, didn't realize that you can fit a tail fin without the skewer. It can still go onto normal pannier rack mounts. Every single one of them comes with adapters included with your tail fin. When you buy a box, it comes in it. So you don't have to, the skewer is nice, but you don't need to use a skewer. You can't actually just mount it directly on. It could even have gone beyond where take the ends of the tail fin and then screws would fit through that and just screw into your normal pannier rack mounts. So it's not something that needed a special adapter from, even though it comes with a tail fin, you could just go, any bike shop's going to have the bolts. And most bikes actually have the bolts on the frame.
Well, the easiest, I feel like you should be telling them that.
If he just rang me. It would have been over the phone. Yeah, no worries, mate. Take these bolts out of your wherever on your bike, and then that's it fixed. So zero sympathy. I mean, that's shocking. If I was tail fin, I would cancel their sponsorship. And yeah.
Let's head over to our emails, because it's time for Listener's Takeover. We need more jingles, don't we? We definitely need to make some more jingles.
Stop saying it and just do it.
So from Kit in Hong Kong, love the podcast and all the other content. How do you convince or lure? I always find that word really hard to say because people say it as lure.
I would say lure, but...
Lure.
But I say tour and...
Whereas I go lure. Anyway, how would you convince or lure non-cycling friends and family to get into cycling? Bikes and all the accessories can be expensive barriers to entry. Those rental city bikes are all well and good, but they are a bit slow and boring. Maybe a secondhand road bike is a place to start. It's a good question. I think I have some experience in this space because I convinced you to start riding bikes.
Yes, you did. Yeah. How did you do it?
The first thing that I did was I bought you a really cheap bike that was something in line with what you would expect. So it was a town bike. It was upright. It was foldy. It had a basket on the front. It was all the stuff that you would look at in a bike at the time and go like, oh, that looks like fun. Yep. I'll have a little poodle on that, which you did. And you thought it was enjoyable.
Another thing that you did with that bike is you took all of the unnecessary parts off it.
Because that was the next bit.
Yeah. All right. Sorry. Go on.
Then when you were like, actually, this is quite fun, but this bike's a bit of a brute. We then stripped loads of the metal off it because it was
heavy,
very heavy. And then you were like, actually, this is a little bit more enjoyable. And then and then the next phase was to convince you to get a proper bike, which is ultimately something that could be a drop bar handlebar bike in the future. So then you paid, I think, about 500 quid. And then I put an extra £1,500 in without you knowing to get you a custom made steel bike with, again, wraparound bars. And granted, it was way over the top. We didn't need to do this. But the whole point of this was that it could be converted to drop bar if you decided that you liked it even more, which I was pretty confident that you would. So you then had this bike, which very quickly you then again maxed out.
Yeah.
And then we converted to a drop bar bike. And then you were like, right, yeah, this is the one.
We also did some cycling at the Lee Valley Olympic track, which is a 1 mile road circuit, so it's free from cars, it's proper smooth tarmac, and that was the first time I tried a drop bar, and it allowed me to do it away from cars and on a very smooth surface, so really get to grips with that kind of mechanism. I don't think that you're saying the way to do it is spend £2,000 on a custom steel bike, but the point is, I mean, number one, you have to know whether people are actually interested in it. But I think you're right. Do it in stages. Drop bar is a really hard thing to get used to, first of all.
I would say if we'd gone straight to drop bar, you would have been like, this is twitchy and uncomfortable and horrible. I have no interest in this.
Yeah, I agree. And I knew how to ride a bike. I had not done it for a long, long time. But yeah, it's a completely different beast, isn't it?
We also did a lot of road etiquette education,
yeah,
if that's an appropriate way. Ultimately, I taught you how to ride on the roads in London and not get killed.
Yeah, safety is a massive issue, and it's one of the there's studies into it that show that safety is one of the main barriers to entry of taking up cycling, as well as free time. But breaking down those barriers to safety, being able to, if you've got access to off-road paths that you can practice on, or you know, safe spaces to do that, and learning about etiquette, that can be one of a really, really good way to break down those barriers and make it seem fun rather than terrifying.
I would say 100% do not buy a mid-range bike at all. Don't be spending £1,000 on a bike.
No.
Because the problem is that two things are going to happen. Either they're going to not get into it, and you've wasted a lot of money, or they're going to get into it properly, you still wasted a lot of money, because then they're going to want a nicer bike, especially if you are coming from a cycling background and riding very seriously and you've got all this kit and all these things, and then essentially start doing things together. I would suggest you buy a really cheap, decent quality hardtail mountain bike. Hardtail mountain bikes tend to be the cheapest bikes to buy because they're made in mass. And it's something that if you were to get into it properly, ride loads and get yourself a road bike or gravel bike or whatever bike you want, it's not a wasted bike. It's something you can still use around the town or like as your commuting bike or going to the shops.
I guess the other thing to work out is how much time are you willing to dedicate to helping ease that person into the transition? Yeah. Because, you know, if you're expecting to do two sessions and then wanting to go off and do, you know, a faster ride or a longer ride, then they might not be capable of doing that. And there's nothing worse than feeling like you're slowing someone up or getting dropped or whatever. So I guess be willing yourself to commit the time as well to making it enjoyable.
So from Sam, at the start of June, I'm going to be participating in an event called the Alpe d'Huez's, where I'll attempt to ride up Alpe d'Huez 6 times in 1 day with thousands of others for cancer research. My question is about gear ratios. I have a Cannondale Synapse with all the stock parts. I believe it's a 50-34 front chainring and 11-34 rear cassette, meaning I already have a pretty easy gear with a 1-to-1 gear ratio. I've used this bike to climb Mount Ventoux, but my cadence will significantly lower than usual for large sections of the climb. So I'm worried that, especially when I'm tired after 4 or 5 ascents, that I'll really be grinding my way up. According to Shimano, I can't fit a bigger cassette on my current derailleur. Can I go outside of the recommended Shimano range without causing any damage? And if so, is it worth buying a bigger cassette? Also, side note, would massively appreciate it if you could shout out my donation link. People can sponsor me individually or the event as a whole, and all money donated goes to cancer research.
Yeah, I'll put a link in the description for that.
Link in the description for Sam.
Simple answer, no. I get this. Wait, in the
no
shop.
To which bit?
To going outside the limits of what the max says.
Right.
There's forums on the internet that says you can get bigger and stuff.
I've done it loads of times. It works fine.
No.
It's a warranty breach, but I've done it loads of times and it works. You can even get a wolf tooth link extender. So wolf tooth make a part which literally enable it to officially work, I think, as well.
I'm just saying to you, from a bike shop perspective, I had a customer that comes and argues with me about everything in the shop. So he came in the other day and he was saying that Shimano says GRX cassettes can only go up to 42 teeth on the 11-speed ones. But he has read on loads of forums that you can put the 46-tooth one on. And then I said yes, but Shimano says no, so we recommend you don't do it.
Yeah, fair
and he
enough.
Argued. And then in the end, it's like, why are you in the shop? He's like, because it doesn't work. It's like, but I told you it's not going to work. Shimano told you it's not going to work. Yes, but the forum says it will work. It's like, but it doesn't work. It's one of those, just generally speaking, I would say no. Don't do that. If it's a big event, you can do that. See if you've got a friend who's got a gravel rear derailleur and a cassette and borrow one. Swap it out, because most of the 11-speed Shimano's, if I'm assuming this Shimano looking at this, it's got it's interchangeable pull ratios on the 11-speed. So borrow a GRX rear mech off a friend and then put an 11-42 cassette on and you're going to have a massive ratio. I don't know if that'll work with your front mech. Sorry, chain set. But yeah, it's generally, no, I wouldn't budge it. I would, yeah. So
I think going back to the source of his question, I would definitely say if there is the option to have more gear range, take
better,
it.
Yes.
Like, just take it. There is not going to be a scenario on that event or climbing any hill where you go like, oh, I'm so disappointed that I can make this easier for myself.
I also think if that's in your mind now, it's really going to be in your mind when things get hard on the fourth climb, whether that is the issue or not. I don't know. For me, that would be a sort of little brain worm that buried in that was,
There's a bizarre thing with road cycling. So technically speaking, a 1-to-1 ratio in terms of efficiency, if you get to 1-to-1 and you feel you need more gears, it'll be more efficient. Even if you ride it 1-to-1, it's more efficient if you had no luggage. So this is talking in the sense of no luggage in your bike and it's on road. It's actually more efficient to climb off your bike and walk. You'll use less energy.
It's not the point, though, is
speed.
It? It's not the point.
It's not the point. What I'm saying is, on a general climb, I say to people, if it's just for everyday riding, then I wouldn't, because I would just get off and walk, because you'll use less energy. So you'll be less tired. But saying this, where it's 6 times up the same one, you have to start thinking of energy for late in the day. And like, I mean, you're going to continuously be climbing. I would get easier ratio. But for going to Mont Ventoux, Alpe d'Huez and doing all of this, it's going to be hotels, it's going to be trips and stuff. I would see if you can borrow different rear derailleur and possibly chain set to make it easier, or buy one.
Yeah, if money isn't an option, which doesn't really apply to anyone apart from 0.001% of people, then I would say change something so that you've got more gear ratio. So I was riding my gravel bike on road yesterday, and I've got a 42 chainring with a 52 biggest ring on the cassette on my Howler. So it's a 42 front chainring with a 10-52 rear cassette. And I was using that 52 to climb up some of the climbs I was going up yesterday. And I was like, I love that I have this outrageous gear ratio because it allows me just to spin and enjoy it. So I definitely think you should get some more stuff. You shouldn't technically ever go outside of manufacturer's warranty. I have done it myself, or manufacturer's recommendations. I have done it myself and made stuff work. It always is a botch and it doesn't work amazingly, and you'll probably need to get a new chain because it'll be too short. Wolf's Tooth do a thing which enable you to get a couple of extra something or other in, so have a look at that option. Alternatively, look at a different rear mech or different chain rings or something along those lines. If you are unsure, speak to a local bike shop that has some good recommendations from your mates.
A new cassette with bigger ratio will be just as expensive as buying a mountain bike chain set, a cheaper one, and then get a mountain bike chain set with like a 28 or 30 tooth ring, because I'm assuming you're only going to be worried about running uphill, not downhill.
Yeah.
So then you can get more than 1-to-1 ratio if you do it that way.
Well, if he goes with to a really set, chain ring on it, he's definitely going to need a chain as well.
Yes. So that way, if you just go for a really small, I'm talking like 28 tooth chain ring onto a mountain bike cassette, or some people do aftermarket ones that might fit to his chain set.
Yeah.
You can still use your current cassette. You can use your current chain. You're just going to have to shorten it and then buy a new chain afterwards. But yeah, that's going to give you, because I assume for this kind of event, all you worry about is riding uphill. Downhill, you're not going to be, Alpe d'Huez has got 21 switchbacks, I think. You're not hammering it down there. You're just going to freewheel all the way down,
yeah,
turn around and ride up. That's going to be the cheapest option, I think.
Good luck for your event. Sounds brutal.
Thank you to those that sent in questions for Nick. We had quite a few extras, so we're going to release some more of those in a future episode. Next week's guest is our pal James. He's an elite cyclist, a professional cycling coach, and has a special interest in sports psychology. So please send him your questions to wildonespodcast@cademedia.co.uk, and we will chat through them in next week's show. Before we go, I just want to say a massive thank you. Thanks for listening and thanks for leaving us a 5-star review. It really helps us grow the podcast. If you're listening to the audio version and haven't yet, please go leave us a review. If you're watching on YouTube, please like and subscribe. Thank you for your continued support. We appreciate it very much. Thank you. Goodbye. See you on the next one.
Cheers, Nick.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.